communiques. Although I have made inquiries, I have failed to find out with any certainty what Antony's replies were. Fulvia felt herself to be in danger. She feared even for their children, not unreasonably. A century later, she was largely forgotten. It was tidier to indict the Alexandrian Antony for being so under the sway of his passion and of his drunkenness that he gave not a thought either to his allies or to his enemies. The reunion in Greece was stormy. Antony was severe with his wife. She had overstepped her bounds and overplayed his hand. Plutarch thought Cleopatra much in Fulvia's debt for teaching Antony to endure a woman's sway, since she took him over quite tamed and schooled at the outset to obey women. Fulvia may well have taught her husband to obey a woman, but could not persuade him either to challenge Octavian or to aspire to more than half an empire. Repeatedly, she exhorted him to ally with Pompey's son Sextus. Together, the two could handily eliminate Octavian. Antony would not hear of it. He had signed an accord. He did not violate his agreements. Weeks later, on the high seas, Antony confronted one of Caesar's assassins. He had been proscribed, had opposed Antony at Philippi, and now approached swiftly with a full fleet. A terrified aide suggested that Antony turn aside. He would consider no such thing, swearing that he would rather die as a result of a breach of treaty than be recognized as a coward and live. He sailed on. To repair the damage with Octavian, Antony left without saying goodbye. Fulvia was ill when he did so. Many of the charges against her may have been invented. Impugning independent-minded women was a specialty of the Roman historian, and Fulvia had had plenty of accomplices. Antony's procurer had encouraged her, having repeatedly and maliciously pointed out that if Italy remained at peace, Antony would stay with Cleopatra, but if there were a war, he would come back without delay. With his new fleet, Antony headed to the Adriatic. In his absence, Fulvia became seriously depressed and died. The cause is unclear. Appian supposes she may have taken her own life out of spite, because she was angry with Antony for leaving her when she was sick. She may simply have been exhausted from the incessant meddling. She could not have been much mourned in Alexandria. Antony, on the other hand, was deeply affected by the death, for which he berated himself. He had not even returned to see his wife in her illness. Others held him responsible, too, writing the neglect down, as Dio chides, to his passion for Cleopatra and her wantonness. Fulvia had been handsome and serious-minded and devoted. She had come to the marriage with money, influential friends, and shrewd political instincts. She had borne Antony two sons. If in truth she was a virago, she was, as has been pointed out, at least an infinitely loyal virago. Antony had thrived at her side. Fulvia's death was arguably her most pacific act. It opened the way for a reconciliation between Octavian and Antony, now rid of an interfering woman whose jealousy of Cleopatra had made her fan the flames of such a serious war. As it was easy to write off an absurd and costly war down to a woman's machinations, so it was easy to write off an accord to her demise, the more so as no one was inclined to fight in the first place. Sextus Pompey remained active at sea. He had vigorously blocked the grain routes to Rome. Incessant war had destroyed Italian agriculture. Rome was a starving, unruly city, at the limits of its endurance. The countryside was in revolt. Soldiers lobbied for the funds Antony was to have obtained abroad, and had yet to distribute. Friends stepped in as go-betweens, again reconciling the two men, who again divided the world between them with Octavian making out more handsomely than he had 2 years earlier. This was the Treaty of Brundisium of early October 40. By its terms, Antony was to battle the Parthians, while Octavian was to fend off or reach an agreement with Sextus Pompey. Some 8 months later, the three men would accordingly sign a new agreement in Misenum across the bay from Naples, the summit of Pompeii in the background. No sooner had those pacts been drafted, no sooner had the men embraced, than a great and mighty shout arose from the mainland and from the ships at the same moment. Even the mountains resounded with joy. In the ensuing harbor-front chaos, many were trampled, suffocated, or drowned as they embraced one another while swimming and threw their arms around one another's necks as they dived. Armed conflict had again been averted, although the all-night Brundisium celebrations spoke as loudly as did the agreements themselves. In tents along the coast, both camps fed at each other through a day and a night. Octavian did so in the Roman fashion, Antony in the Asiatic and Egyptian style, which passed without comment. All the same, when they did so at Misenum, their ships were moored close by, guards were stationed around, and those actually attending the dinner carried daggers concealed beneath their clothing. Conspiracies brewed and plots were extinguished throughout the cordial banqueting. To join the two men personally after Brundisium, Octavian offered up his adored half-sister to Antony. Here was the one realm in which a Roman woman commanded a premium. She made for an invaluable personal guarantee, especially when it came to closing a political deal. Circumspect and sober, Octavia had at 29 all the makings of the long-suffering political wife. She was intelligent, but not independent, a mediator rather than a manipulator. While she had studied philosophy, she harbored no political ambitions. A wonder of a woman, she was an acknowledged beauty, graceful, fine-featured, with a glossy mane of magnificent hair. Conveniently, she had been widowed months earlier. She was precisely what the situation required, an eminently qualified counterweight to Cleopatra, from whom she was intended to divert Antony. By his own admission, he remained under that faraway spell. His reason was still battling with his love, as Plutarch has it, and as Antony's men well knew. They ribbed him mercilessly about the affair. By law, a widow was to wait 10 months before remarrying to allow for the birth of any progeny. All parties counted so fervently on Octavia to restore harmony and be their complete salvation that the Senate hurriedly passed an exemption. At the end of December 40, the Brundisium festivities continued in Rome, where Antony and Octavia celebrated their marriage. Rome was hardly in a festive mood. It was famished, plundered, exhausted, but the news must especially have rankled in Alexandria. The pacts of 40 and 39 could not have surprised, but may have alarmed Cleopatra. Antony's marriage was one thing, his commitment to his brother-in-law another. It was not in Cleopatra's best interest for Antony and Octavian to join forces. Octavian was her mortal enemy, a walking, plotting insult to her son. On the other hand, she knew her man. Antony would be back. She did not need to make any advances, as the Parthians could be counted on to do so. She may well have come to feel perversely grateful to the Parthians, who distracted the Romans from Egypt. They accentuated her importance. Antony could hardly effect his part of the Brundisium bargain without her. Cleopatra had fair reason to believe that reconciliation fragile, if not hollow. Antony and Octavian could reconcile as many times as they liked. The enmity, as Fulvia had forcefully argued months earlier, would not vanish. Cleopatra could have guessed at the daggers, and did not need to. She had informers in Antony's camp who conveyed news of every detail, of the plots and counterplots, the skirmishing and banqueting, to Alexandria. She was in contact, at least indirectly, with Mark Antony, to whom she sent a caller that winter. The Parthians swept through Phoenicia, Palestine, and Syria to plunder Jerusalem at the end of the year. Herod, the 32-year-old Judean tetrarch, or prince, Rome would crown him king only the following year, managed a harrowing escape. Having settled his family at the fortress of Masada, he cast about for asylum. It was not immediately forthcoming. His neighbors were unwilling to displease their invaders. Herod made his way finally to Alexandria, where Cleopatra received him in style. She knew him primarily as an excitable friend of Antony's and as a fellow Roman client, but had additional reason to be favorably disposed toward him. Herod's father had twice assisted in Ptolemaic restorations, both hers and that of her father. In 47, he had personally launched a vigorous, artful assault on the eastern frontier and rallied Egypt's Jews to Caesar's cause. Like their fathers, Cleopatra and Herod were former Pompeians, late converts to Caesar. They had a common enemy in the Parthians. Herod was, moreover, an entertaining companion, glib and keen, fanatical in his loyalties, expert in his displays of deference. Evidently, Cleopatra attempted to enlist the dashing prince in an expedition, either of her own into Ethiopia, or with Antony in Parthia. It was unsurprising that she should offer him a command. Jewish officers had long served in the Ptolemaic forces, and Herod was particularly distinguished. An expert horseman, he could throw a javelin with unerring precision. He declined the offer. In the end, Cleopatra supplied him with a galley. She seemed forever to be handing out ships in which to make a risky winter crossing to Rome, an unusual kind of hospitality, and one that involved Herod in a shipwreck off the coast of Cyprus. He washed up in Rome only weeks later, to be welcomed warmly by Octavian and Antony. In the worst light, Cleopatra's was a diversionary tactic. Grateful though she may have felt toward Herod's family, she had no great interest in encouraging her neighbor's friendship with Antony. We have no idea how or if Cleopatra delivered another piece of news, which likely preceded Herod across the Mediterranean. At the end of the year, she gave birth to twins. Their father was absent. He was at about this time either marrying Octavia or on the verge of doing so. But the children did not want for glorious antecedents. In naming them, Cleopatra made no concessions to their paternal heritage. She went Rome one better. She named Antony's children Alexander Helios and Cleopatra Selene, at once summoning the sun, the moon, her great aunt, the remarkable second-century Ptolemaic queen, and the greatest commander of the age, the one who had tamed even the Parthians, and to whom she alone among reigning sovereigns maintained a link. Given the way she was stockpiling successors, Cleopatra was arguably doing more to unite East and West than had anyone since Alexander the Great. The sun and the moon figured in the Parthian king's title. Cleopatra may have been sending him a message. Surely there was no better way to inaugurate a golden age than with a sun god. We know nothing of Antony's reaction to the news, but Octavian's would have been yet more interesting. In some roundabout way, Cleopatra had seen to it that the two men were, by way of her children, again related. She did not have to broadcast word of the sensational births. News that the enterprising queen of Egypt had borne a son named Alexander, whose father was Mark Antony and whose half-brother was a child of Caesar, constituted a banner headline in 39 BC. It was enough to make Cleopatra, to borrow a much later phrase, an object of gossip for for the whole world. From 40 to 37, Cleopatra lived as in a Greek drama. All the violence occurred off stage. Reports were conveyed to her from a distance. She parsed them carefully. With the Treaty of Brundisium, the Mediterranean world breathed a sigh of relief, if one that felt cold on the back of the Egyptian neck. Antony's marriage was a thrilling solution for a worn and depleted Roman people. Throughout Italy, Antony and Octavian were immediately praised to the skies for bringing peace. Men were rid of war in their own country and of the conscription of their sons, rid of the violence of military outposts and of the desertion of their slaves, rid of the plundering of farmland and of the interruption to agriculture, and rid, above all, of the famine which had brought them to the limits of their endurance. In the countryside, people sacrificed, as if to savior gods, a role both Antony and Octavian embraced. Statues were erected to the peace, and coins minted. With the celebrations came misty-eyed dreams and colorful prophecies. Suddenly, a rosy age of brotherhood and prosperity dawned. Virgil wrote his much-palpated fourth eclogue at this time, possibly to celebrate the marriage of Antony and Octavia, certainly to summon a golden age. The poet pinned messianic hopes on a child who was yet to be born, a savior who would usher in a new dawn and reign over a world of piety, peace, and plenty. For those breathless prophecies to be realized, the world had to wait a little longer. In the spring of 38, Octavia dutifully produced a child. It was a daughter, however, rather than the much-heralded son. And the Parthians continued their westward advance, delighted to exploit Rome's internal distractions. Cleopatra, too, kept a careful eye on the invaders as they neared her border. They were intent on expansion. The empire of their Persian predecessors had included Egypt. Antony dispatched a trusted general to engage the Parthians. Much to Antony's annoyance, he did so beautifully, soaking up the glory for which his commander thirsted. And hungry Rome exploded again in riots. The unrest had been so great earlier that Octavian had found himself surrounded in the forum by a seething mob, which castigated him for having exhausted the public funds. Paving stones met his attempts to explain himself. The bombardment continued even as the blood began to flow. Antony had swooped in to effect a spectacular rescue, snatching Octavian with some difficulty and amid shouts and screams from his assailants. He escorted his fellow triumvir to his house for what was a very different visit from their initial interview there. Otherwise, Antony's brother-in-law was not proving a cooperative partner, as Fulvia earlier had warned him, and from thousands of miles away, as Cleopatra managed still to do. A friendly spirit prevailed between the two men, on congenial terms and best behavior. All the same, Mark Antony, the war hero, the senior statesman, the popular favorite, seemed continually to be bested by his stubborn and sickly brother-in-law. Certainly, he had reason to be astounded by Octavian's very ability to continue on the scene. Octavian had already been several times on his deathbed, continually coughing and sneezing, susceptible to sunstroke, a reluctant warrior. He hardly seemed a worthy match for the barrel-chested, mighty-thighed Mark Antony. Octavian was morose, paranoid, fastidious. He wore lifts in his shoes. And yet at every juncture, he continued to surprise Antony. A victim of his own easygoing confidence, acting from what he perceived to be his superior position, Antony regularly found himself manipulated. He engaged in a rivalry he had not even considered one, with a rash boy who had come from nowhere. Antony was without guile, of which he was often oblivious. Octavian was without charm, equally lost on him. He was the kind of man who would later brag about the number of triumphs he had been offered, but had not celebrated, which amounted to boasting about his humility. Antony would never for a minute have turned down such honors, and cheerfully admitted as much. Somehow, Octavian managed to best his elder, even in casual games of skill and chance. Whether the two bet on a cockfight or played cards, when they cast lots to decide political matters, if they tossed a ball between them, Mark Antony inevitably, improbably, wound up diminished. It is easy to see why. Octavian could spin any outcome to his advantage. If he lost excessive amounts at the gaming table, it was, he explained, only because he behaved with excessive sportsmanship. At Antony's side, Cleopatra had installed a soothsayer. Many in Rome believed that an astrologer could predict a human career with as much accuracy as a solar eclipse. Antony spoke of his frustration to the seer, who cast his horoscope. Speaking either the truth or for his employer, he offered up a frank analysis. Antony's prospects were splendid, but fated to be eclipsed by Octavian's. The problem, explained the seer, was that Antony's guardian genius lived in fear of his colleagues, and though it has a spirited and lofty mien when it is by itself, when his comes near, yours is cowed and humbled by it. He was to steer clear of his colleague. The explanation made sense to Antony, who held the astrologer in new esteem and approached his brother-in-law with new wariness. In what was perhaps a veiled invitation to Alexandria, the seer advised Antony to put as much distance as possible between himself and that young man. He got only as far as Athens, where he settled for the winter and which he made his headquarters for the next 2 years. He passed the winter of 39 much as he had passed the previous one, in a comfortable, cultivated city of superb architecture and fine statuary. He left lieutenants in the field, but did no more than look over their reports. He dismissed his entourage. He made the rounds of lectures and festivals with a few friends and attendants, or with Octavia, with whom he appeared deeply happy. Again, he exchanged the purple cloak of a commander for Eastern dress. Again, he exultantly passed himself off as Dionysus, his preferred form of address. He allowed Octavia, who quickly bore him a second daughter, to be hailed as Athena. We know how those tributes registered in Alexandria, as Cleopatra collected every detail of them. They were particularly galling as they verged on the sacred and the imperial. What a difference an address, or a change of consort, makes! There would be no Roman hand-wringing in 39 over Antony's winter of dissipation. In Athens, he dressed like a Greek and reveled like a Greek, but he did so under the watchful eye of the virtuous Octavia. It was, moreover, difficult to attack his divine pretensions when Octavian affected the same. He threw a costume party for which he dressed as Apollo. Only Antony, however, conspicuously built a hut of branches, decorated it with drums, tambourines, greenery, animal skins, and other Dionysian props, and lay inside with his friends, beginning at dawn, and got drunk. He summoned musicians from Italy to entertain at his hillside den. At times, he moved his installation up to the Acropolis, and the entire city of Athens was illuminated by the lamps that hung from the ceilings. He continued to be perplexed by his brother-in-law's ability to control the conversation. While commanding a reputation for stolid probity, Octavian managed in 38 to slip out of his marriage on the day his wife gave birth to wed Livia, 6 months pregnant with her previous husband's child. It was a marriage that delivered Octavian to the upper ranks of Roman society, making him Antony's equal. Despite the connection to Caesar, Octavian's lineage was not noble. Repeatedly, he managed to cripple and confound his brother-in-law. If he promised one thing, he delivered another. If Antony headed east, Octavian summoned him west, then neglected to appear. He allowed Antony to recruit soldiers on Italian soil, next to impossible, as Octavian governed that territory. It made for a tenuous balancing act, but one that Antony was determined to maintain. He swallowed his pride and masked his irritation, even as his patience was rubbed raw. Matters finally came to a head late in the spring of 37, when the two met alongside a river in the south of the Italian peninsula to air several seasons of grievances. Octavia helped to broker a peace, delivering an impassioned Helen of Troy speech. She had no desire to watch her husband and brother destroy each other. The result was the Pact of Tarentum, a renewal of the expired triumvirate. Antony would be recognized as dictator in the east through December 33. He emerged satisfied. Nearly everything, notes Dio, was going as he wished. He prepared at last for his campaign and headed east to Syria. Octavia and their two daughters accompanied him as far as western Greece, where he sent them back. Octavia was pregnant again. Further travel, Antony protested, would be detrimental to her health. Already she had 6 children, including those from prior marriages, in her care. He was eager that, as he put it, she might not share his danger while he was warring against the Parthians. This was all perfectly true. If Octavian was a flinty master of indirection, capable of appearing to cooperate while doing no such thing, Antony was a quick-change artist, given to dramatic about-faces. In Athens, he was one day the layabout, languidly attending festivals in Octavia's company and neglecting public business the next, having rethought his wardrobe and snapped to attention, the sharp-minded military man, a tornado of activity, all diplomatic business, at the magnetic center of an entourage. Something gave way in the last months of 37. Possibly the long list of insults, disillusionments, and dodges suddenly added up. Possibly he burst with pent-up frustration. He was a soldier whose glorious campaign had been postponed and postponed. His lieutenant reaped a series of victories in the east, victories that were rightfully his. Perhaps Antony realized that between them, his wife and brother-in-law were holding him in check, that he was being played for the fool, that collaboration seemed less and less possible. Certainly the obvious way to secure the upper hand at home was with a blazing military victory abroad. To crush the Parthians was to eliminate Octavian, a strange sort of asymmetrical accounting, not entirely unlike Auletes' Roman calculation of 2 decades earlier. Plutarch offers a different explanation for the reversal of 37. He acknowledges the Parthian fixation, but cites as well a dire evil which had been slumbering for a long time. Antony's friends assumed that over the course of 3.5 years, that hankering had released its hold, charmed away by Octavia, or at least lulled to rest by better considerations. In Plutarch's account, the desire suddenly smoldered to grow more and more combustible as Antony traveled east, where ultimately it reignited and burst into flames. Plutarch meant to get his history right, but it should be remembered that he was making of Antony's life a cautionary tale. His Antony is a talented man brought to ruin by his own passion. The moral may have been more important than the details. Whatever the circumstances, safely arrived in Syria, Antony defied both his better instincts and cool counsel. He sent a messenger to Alexandria. Cleopatra was to meet him in Antioch, the 3rd great city of the Mediterranean world. This time, she set sail post-haste. Not long after the couple's arrival in the Syrian capital, Coins circulated bearing joint portraits of Antony and Cleopatra. It is unclear who is meant to be on the obverse and who on the reverse, which was, in brief, the intermittent riddle of the next 7 tumultuous years. Antony never saw Octavia again. Chapter 7. An Object of Gossip for the Whole World. The greatest achievement for a woman is to be as seldom as possible spoken of. Thucydides. She had no need to indulge in costume drama this time around. Cleopatra knew before she sailed that fall that Mark Antony was heading east, finally to settle the Roman score with Parthia, a campaign he had delayed now for 4 years. She knew of his preoccupation from their riotous winter together. From Caesar, she would have heard details of the original plans for that expedition. As he made his way toward Antioch, Antony reorganized Asia Minor, carving out kingdoms for those he trusted and those who supported him. He established a stable frontier. It was essential that he shore up his rear before proceeding east. To the same end, Antony and Octavian had together arranged a kingship for Herod when he had finally washed up in Rome that winter. Of Idumean and Arab descent, Herod was by no means the obvious candidate for the Judean throne. His tenacity, rather than his heritage, secured him the crown. No dynast more eloquently explained away his misguided loyalty to Cassius. It would fairly be said of Herod that he had slinked into power. Antony had known his father, also a friend to Rome, and he had met Herod as a teenager. The personal rapport counted for a great deal. A rough-edged opportunist, Herod was endearingly reckless, a master of the miraculous escape. The evidence suggests a fascination with him in Rome, on Octavian's part, as much as on Antony's. Not coincidentally, Herod was as much a swashbuckler when it came to raising funds as throwing a javelin. He had an astonishing talent for plucking gold from thin air. His subjects had some insight into his methods. The Senate unanimously confirmed the kingship, after which Octavian and Antony escorted Herod between them to the capital, a signal honor. Consuls and magistrates led the way. Antony argued that the appointment would be advantageous to the Eastern campaign. He afterward threw a banquet in the new king's honor. By some accounts, Herod owed his throne equally to Cleopatra. The Senate was as much motivated by fear of her as by admiration of him. They distinctly preferred 2 monarchs in the region to 1. There was ample reason to be wary of a client queen at the head of a rich kingdom with her finger on Rome's grain supply. That logic worked as well to Cleopatra's advantage. Antony could risk no upheavals in Egypt. She alone could rule that kingdom with authority. Clearly, few could run the country better. As ever, she left Alexandria secure in the knowledge that no Roman could succeed against Parthia, a rich, immense, and well-defended empire, without her financial support. In other words, as she made her way north that fall along the rocky coast of the eastern Mediterranean, she knew that the balance of power had subtly shifted. For all of Antony's bravado, despite his superb army, she was very much in possession of the upper hand. Vanity having changed little in 2 millennia, it seems fair to assume that she and her attendants took scrupulous pains with her appearance. She had not seen Mark Antony in 3.5 years, years any woman would want to render invisible. She had heard about Octavia, the round-faced, gleaming-haired beauty. There was no call for ambrosial robes, gem-encrusted party favors, wall-to-wall roses this time around, however. Cleopatra had something better. On this trip, she took the children. In Antioch, a miniature, less profligate version of Alexandria, Alexander Helios and Cleopatra Selene met their father for the first time. He acknowledged the twins as his own. It could only have been a joyous meeting. Antony had Hellenistic pretensions. He had insinuated himself into the Ptolemaic dynasty. His children were now in line for the Egyptian throne. Moreover, he had a new son, something Octavia, a paragon on every other front, had not produced. Antony had two older sons by Fulvia. Some have gone so far as to suggest that it was precisely her failure to provide a male heir, one who would fulfill Virgil's prophecy and usher in a much-awaited golden age, that drove Antony into the arms of Cleopatra. Generally, Antony liked children and did not believe it possible to have too many. He was fond of saying that noble families were extended by the successive begettings of many kings. He was hardly the kind of man who could have resisted a Greek-speaking minor deity of a 3-year-old who dressed as a royal, who addressed Antony as father, and who, if sculpture can be trusted, in his fleshy face and mop of bouncing curls, resembled him as well. Establishing a divine claim had been at the top of Antony's agenda for years. He'd been edging that way since Philippi, following the example of his illustrious mentor. With his illegitimate children, Antony legitimately stepped, as a modern historian has put it, into his predecessor's bedroom slippers. It was especially appropriate that he do so in Antioch, a scenic, well-provisioned river city at the foot of a majestic mountain, with a colonnaded downtown grid and an ample supply of stadiums and gardens, monumental fountains and natural springs. Bathed in westerly breezes from May to October, Antioch was sunny and windless in winter, with delightful baths and a lively market. Well inclined toward Caesar, who had commissioned a statue of himself there after leaving Cleopatra in 47, the Syrian capital warmly welcomed his celebrated protege. Cleopatra had every personal reason to delight in the long-delayed family reunion, but the political satisfactions were greater still. Antony had taken her fishing advice. He was doing what she felt, or for her own reasons, led him to believe he did best. Devoting himself to a worthy sport, he was reeling in cities, provinces, and kingdoms. It is not inaccurate to say that realms and islands were as plates dropped from his pocket, as would be suggested later. For the most part, there was a compelling logic to Antony's dispositions. He engaged in a long-needed, often attempted ordering of the restive East. In a multi-ethnic, multicultural region of shifting alliances, one that had resisted 30 years of Roman efforts at reorganization, he recognized talent, rewarded competence, and loyalty. As Antony liked to say, the greatness of the Roman Empire was made manifest not by what the Romans received, but by what they bestowed. Consolidating kingdoms, he ably merged territories and assigned lands. He redrew geography. He was in his element and manifestly invincible. No one doubted his imminent triumph over the dreaded Parthians. Rarely had anyone assembled an army more conspicuous for prowess, endurance, or youthful vigor. Antony's made all Asia quiver. It was the greatest force he would command, its men uniquely devoted to their large-hearted, free-wheeling general. Each preferred his good opinion to their very lives, a devotion born, Plutarch effuses, of the nobility of his family, his eloquence, his frank and open manners, his liberal and magnificent habits, his familiarity in talking with everybody. Antony's mood was contagious. There were high spirits all around. Handing out gifts is always uplifting, and munificence was something he did especially well. It was a corollary to his embrace of large families. In sunny Antioch, the two likely stayed at the island palace, nestled in the bend of the placid river. Cleopatra had reason to congratulate herself and to believe that, emerging from 5 years of chaos and confusion, she had backed the right horse. Upon her September arrival, Antony, moreover, made her an extraordinary present. Not only did he acknowledge his 3-year-old twins, but he showered a vast collection of territories on their mother. He confirmed her authority over the island of Cyprus, which even Caesar had not officially granted her. The memory of its loss and the effects of that monumental loss could only have burned bright. To Cleopatra's lands, he added as well wooded, sealy Syria, part of which is today Lebanon, lush, far-off Cyrene in modern Libya, a generous swath of cedar-heavy Cilicia, the eastern coast of Turkey, portions of Crete, and all but 2 cities of the thriving Phoenician coast. In several cases, Antony eliminated sovereigns. If an offense could not be found, one could always be fabricated, so that Cleopatra might assume their territories. As of 37, Cleopatra ruled over nearly the entire eastern Mediterranean coast, from what is today eastern Libya in Africa, north through Israel, Lebanon, and Syria, to southern Turkey, excepting only slivers of Judea. Antony's military needs and Roman score settling largely determined the size and shape of the grant. So did his opinion of Cleopatra. She was proficient, reliable, resourceful. This was what Rome looked for in its client rulers, who had several advantages over Roman appointees, one of which was that they did not need to be paid. More to the point, Antony needed a navy. By the time of the Tarentum Treaty, he had delivered 100 bronze-beaked galleys and 10 triremes to Octavian. Cleopatra knew how to build ships. For good reason, Antony assigned timber-rich provinces to a monarch who had the tradesmen and the resources to transform them into a worthy fleet. In that regard, no one in the Mediterranean world was as valuable to Antony as was Cleopatra. As Plutarch acknowledged, her gifts were but some among many distributed to eastern rulers. At the same time, she was one of the rare sovereigns who remained in place. Antony regularly circumvented established dynasties in making appointments, and Cleopatra received a far more generous gift than that bestowed on any other ruler. By September 37, she had nearly reconstituted the Ptolemaic Empire in its 3rd century glory. For good reason, she declared a new era for Egypt. Cleopatra's 16th regnal year was henceforth to be known as the Year One, a double dating she continued throughout her reign. And at 32, she redefined herself, assuming an original title. Among the many unconventional privileges Cleopatra enjoyed, naming herself surely figured among the most significant, on par with choosing her consort or managing her own income. She was henceforth Queen Cleopatra, the goddess, the younger, father-loving, and fatherland-loving. She was as astute a manipulator of nomenclature as of much else, and a good deal has been read into that title. With it, Cleopatra announced not only a new age, but a full-scale political reorientation. She may have appended the final term to discourage murmurs that she was selling out to the Romans. With it, Cleopatra signaled to her subjects that she was first and foremost their pharaoh. Footnote. Some have read into her grandiloquence an alignment instead with her Greek heritage. Genuine or not, a revival was unfailingly welcome in a world that measured itself against the past. Hers may have been an expansive, inclusionary gesture. Macedonia had produced not only the Ptolemies, but the rival Seleucid dynasty as well. And the once powerful Seleucids had controlled much of the territory now in Cleopatra's hands. End of footnote. Certainly the imagery on her coins is reassuringly consistent with that of previous Ptolemies. By any name, she was as powerful a figure as existed on the non-Roman stage. When Antony had vanquished the Parthians, she would be Empress of the East. Various coastal cities acknowledged as much, issuing coins in Antony and Cleopatra's honor. She had every reason to be ecstatic. There was not a smudge on the horizon. Cleopatra could only have looked forward to celebrating the new dawn in Alexandria. Having sacrificed all after the Ides of March, she had not only regained a foothold, but fared better this time around. Their pride in the newly established empire aside, how did her subjects take to her close collaboration with a second Roman? There is no trace of scandal. Her people remained focused on the practical implications of Cleopatra's diplomacy. It seems to me, an eminent scholar has suggested, that the loves and births of a female pharaoh struck them as divine matters, and that they questioned their queen only when her tax collectors pressed too stringently. She had cleverly solved a political puzzle. The lack of resistance at home may indicate as well that she was not unduly generous with Mark Antony. She may have agreed to pay for his legions, but that Cleopatra could afford without oppressive levies on her people. Nor was there reason to believe Antony's territorial dispositions set off alarms in Rome. They were part of a consistent foreign policy. They enriched the coffers and secured the frontiers. In Egypt, Cleopatra's popularity could only have been at an all-time high. In light of the gift, many have concluded that Mark Antony and Cleopatra married in Antioch that fall. An awkward proposition, as Antony already had a wife. And given his munificence, many have assumed that Cleopatra specified what she would like on the occasion, to which request Antony acceded. There is no evidence of either in Plutarch, the sole source for the reunion, and not a chronicler inclined to omit such a transaction. He allows only that Antony acknowledged their mutual children, by no means tantamount to marriage. Certainly Antony had as much, if not more, to be gained as did Cleopatra. Even Plutarch could not call it a mistake for the Roman triumvir to ally himself with the richest woman in his world. His immediate practical needs dovetailed neatly with her long-range imperial ambitions. There is less evidence of a wedding than of Cleopatra's thirst for territory, which manifested itself for the first time now. Either in 37 or the following year, she is said to have pestered Antony for the bulk of Judea. He apparently refused. His tenacity on that front has been held up as evidence that he was not putty in her strong hands. He withheld the grant, hence he was not out of his mind with love. Just as possibly, Cleopatra knew her limits and never asked for Judea, which leaves open the question of Antony's emotional state. It is unlikely that she had to haggle for territory, though she was well positioned to do so. Antony needed to finance a campaign, pay an army, supplement a navy. Cleopatra needed nothing. Hers was the better negotiating position. Whatever transpired between the two, the perception among the other client kings in the region was that Antony was deeply, resolutely attached to Cleopatra. It is more difficult to read what was in her heart, at least in 37. We have a few hints, however. Before or after Egypt expanded to its third century proportions, before or after she reset the calendar, Antony and Cleopatra resumed their sexual relationship, picking up where they had left off in Tarsus. And evidently, Antony's presence meant as much to Cleopatra as did his patronage. In March or April 36, She accompanied him along the broad, flat road from Antioch to the edge of the Roman Empire, an overland trip that took her hundreds of miles out of her way. It was unnecessary for her, and less comfortable than it might otherwise have been, as she was again pregnant. Antony and Cleopatra said their goodbyes on the banks of the Euphrates, where the river narrowed into a deep channel in what is today eastern Turkey. He crossed the wooden bridge into Parthian territory to march north with his resplendent army, through the vast obstacle course of steppes and rugged mountains that stretch beyond the Euphrates. Cleopatra headed south. She took the long way home, making a kind of triumphal overland tour of her new possessions. Many were happy to receive her. Some of the despots Antony eliminated on her behalf had been nefarious. Around Damascus, for example, Cleopatra now ruled a territory previously controlled by a tribe of predatory, archery-obsessed bandits. With her entourage, she wound her way over the rolling hills and rugged cliffs of modern-day Syria and Lebanon, through twisting passes and deep ravines, to wind up on the crest of a mountain chain between two lofty hills in Jerusalem. Surrounded by turreted walls and a series of square 30-foot towers, Jerusalem was an eminent commercial center, rich in the arts. Cleopatra had business with Herod, who, though an untiring negotiator, could not have been in any great hurry to discuss it. When last they had met, Herod had been a fugitive and a suppliant. He now sat uneasily on the Judean throne, king of a people he had had to conquer in order to rule. Footnote. Herod, too, is a sovereign without a face, possibly because of the biblical commandment against graven images, we have no likeness of him. End of footnote. Presumably, Cleopatra and her retinue stayed with the newly established sovereign, a collector of homes and a man with a Ptolemaic taste for luxury, though his legendarily opulent palace south of the city had yet to be built. Probably Cleopatra was Herod's guest at his home in the upper city of Jerusalem, by her definition, more of a fortress than a palace. In the course of the visit, she met Herod's fractious extended family, with whom she was about to enter into a subversive correspondence. Herod had the misfortune to share an address with several implacable enemies, first among them his contemptuous, high-born mother-in-law, Alexandra. She represented but one aggravation in Herod's largely female household. He lived as well with his insinuating mother, a grievance-loving, overly loyal sister, and Mariam, the cool, exceptionally beautiful wife who had married him as a teenager and who, to his frustration, somehow could never get past the fact that Herod had murdered half of her family. Though Cleopatra had assisted him 3 years earlier, though they shared a patron and were together navigating the same roiling Roman waters, each was doing his best to sustain a skittish, peculiar country in the shadow of a rising superpower. He had no need for yet another domineering woman. Unlike the others, this one, moreover, had designs on his treasury. For Cleopatra's visit, we have only one source, hostile to his native East, much taken with Rome, working at least partially from Herod's account. The Jewish historian Josephus obscures but cannot entirely camouflage what transpired. Herod and Cleopatra spent some intensive time in each other's company, part of it hammering out the details of his obligations. Antony had granted Cleopatra the exclusive right to the Dead Sea bitumen, or asphalt, glutinous lumps of which floated to the surface of the lake. Bitumen was essential to mortar, incense, and insecticide, to embalming and caulking. A reed basket smeared with asphalt could hold water. Plastered with it, a boat is waterproof. The concession was a lucrative one. Also, Cleopatra's were the proceeds of Jericho, the popular winter resort, lush with date palm groves and balsam gardens. Very likely, she rode out across a searing desert to inspect those 200 acres in the Jordan River Valley, where Herod had a secondary palace. All other scents paled in comparison to sweet balsam, which grew exclusively in Judea. The fragrant shrub's oil, seed, and bark were precious. They constituted the region's most valuable export. As for Jericho's dates, they were the finest in the ancient world, the source of its most potent wine. In modern terms, it was as if Cleopatra had been granted no part of Kuwait, only the proceeds of its oil fields. Herod found the transaction particularly painful, as Judea was a poor country, parched and stony, with few fertile areas, no port, and a rapidly expanding population. His revenues were a risible fraction of Cleopatra's. At the same time, his ambitions exceeded his territory. He had no desire to be king of a wilderness. There appears to have been some bickering over terms in a negotiation that proved Cleopatra more intently focused on bitumen deliveries than seductions. She was relentless and unsparing. The result was highly favorable to her. Herod agreed to lease the Jericho lands for 200 talents annually. He consented as well to guarantee and collect the rent on the bitumen monopoly from his neighbor, the Nabataean king. By agreeing to do so, Herod spared himself the company of any of Cleopatra's agents or soldiers. Otherwise, the arrangement worked entirely to her benefit, all the more so as it made both men miserable. It left Herod to extract funds from a sovereign who had denied him refuge during the Parthian invasion, and who made his payments only under duress. Purposely and effectively, Cleopatra set two men who disliked her, a Jew and an Arab, against each other. Malchus, the Nabataean sovereign, would have his revenge later. Herod nonetheless upheld his end of the agreement with Cleopatra. He felt that it would be unsafe to give her any reason to hate him. The visit was, by all other measures, an unsuccessful one. The two inveterate charmers failed entirely to endear themselves to each other. Cleopatra may have patronized her fellow sovereign. As his royal mother-in-law tirelessly reminded him, Herod was a commoner. Nor was he exactly Jewish, given his mother's religion. In the eyes of the Jews, Herod was a Gentile, while in all other eyes, he was a Jew. He was, as a consequence, perennially insecure about his throne, a situation not unfamiliar to Cleopatra, who may have exacerbated it. Her Aramaic may have been better than his Greek. Several years her senior, Herod was little educated, sorely deficient in history and culture, sensitive on both counts. It says a good deal that when he decided to remedy the situation years later, he hired the finest tutor in the business, one who, in addition to his own literary and musical accomplishments, had the best credential possible. He had been tutor to Cleopatra's children. It could not have helped that Herod would have appeared graceless in Cleopatra's silken presence. Where passions run high, the reverse of the great foreign policy axiom can also prove true. The friend of one's friend is one's enemy. Perhaps Herod felt about Cleopatra the way you inevitably do about someone whose palace puts yours to shame. She may have been too flush with her Antioch success to conciliate. She may well have hinted that she coveted Herod's land. Debts are difficult to acknowledge, and each owed the other. Cleopatra had underwritten Herod's flight to Rome. His father had rushed to Caesar's aid in Alexandria. In any event, the famously entertaining Herod had a violent reaction to his visitor. He doubtless arranged a series of royal banquets for Cleopatra, and arguing that he would be providing a community service, he recommended to his Council of State that they arrange as well for her murder. It could easily be done while she was in Jerusalem and at their mercy. He would eliminate a covetous, conniving neighbor. But everyone stood to benefit, Antony most of all. Heatedly, Herod explained himself. In this way, he said, he would rid of many evils all those to whom she had already been vicious or was likely to be in future. At the same time, he argued, this would be a boon to Antony, for not even to him would she show loyalty if some occasion or need should compel him to ask for it. Herod buttressed his case in the usual way. As ever, the diabolical woman was the sexual one. In addition to all else, he explained to his advisers the Egyptian hussy had laid a treacherous snare for him. Declaring herself overcome with love, she had attempted to force herself upon him, for she was by nature used to enjoying this kind of pleasure without disguise. Herod had as much reason as anyone to observe that Cleopatra was a tough negotiator. And if you're being taken advantage of by a woman, it is convenient to turn that woman into a sexual predator, capable of